and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. Today's show is dedicated to my mom. She would have been 85 today. Would have been her 85th birthday. Hi, Mom! Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd be hit with zoonosis if you made me sick with the idea that you missed today's show. Branding. How do you get people to care about your brand and your cause when there's so much noise out there? It helps to be inclusive and authentic. Our panel from the Nonprofit Technology Conference, 18NTC, explains how. They're James Wu, brand consultant, Christina Jones with Brothers Empowered to Teach, and Rhiannon Tasker from the Public Theater. And focus and attention. Steve Rio has been researching the intersection of mindfulness, creativity, and productivity. He's CEO of BrightWeb. On Tony's Take Two, Baby Boomers. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising, data-driven, and technology-enabled. Tony.ma/Pursuant, capital P. Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, WegnerCPAs.com. By Telos, turning credit card processing into your passive revenue stream, Tony.ma/TonyTelos. And by Text to Give, mobile donations made easy. Text NPR to 444-999. Here is branding from the Nonprofit Technology Conference.
Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of 18NTC. That's the Nonprofit Technology Conference in New Orleans, hosted by the Nonprofit Technology Network. This interview, like all our 18NTC interviews, is sponsored by Network for Good, easy-to-use donor management and fundraising software for nonprofits. My guests are James Wu, Christina Jones, and Rhiannon Tasker. James is an independent brand consultant. Christina is co-founder and CEO, COO of Brothers Empowered to Teach right here in New Orleans. And Rhiannon Tasker is donor communications project manager at the Public Theater. Welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure to have all three of you. Your workshop topic is branding for the apocalypse. Very ominous. How to get people to care about your cause when everything is horrible. Okay. Is part of the horrible that we're thinking about the current political environment and how there's something new every couple of hours? Feel like is a crisis?
Yes.
Is that part of what we're talking about?
That is exactly what we're talking about.
And okay. Is it only that, or?
That's the driver of the conversation in that okay. I remember one day, you know, logging off Twitter for about 30 minutes, coming back on, and literally there were six new horrible things that happened yeah. that were very much tied to the current political climate in the country.
We just learned a couple hours ago that Paul Ryan is not going to run for the House in Wisconsin.
Well, there you go.
That speaks something about what's going on. And there's news like that very, very often.
Yep.
Our challenge is to stand out.
Right.
Okay. Apocalyptic, yeah? Rhiannon, apocalyptic?
I mean, I think that the environment that we're in right now is very divided, and no matter how quickly things change and how fast news is happening, it still feels like we're in a very sort of divided world, and the way that we're feeling after post-election, especially, no matter what side you're on, it's feeling very divided and very sort of... There's a lot of tension right now, and so it feels a little bit tense and uncomfortable sometimes.
Okay, but Christina, we can't overcome. Your org has done it. I guess you've got some lessons to share.
Yes, I think that we have overcome. Because one of the things that we always do, regardless of what's happening politically in the world, is stay true to who we are as an organization. So part of your branding is sort of interpreting that message for what's happening in the world as long as it's a part of who you are.
Okay, so is that your first advice for rising above this noise, is staying true
yes,
to who you are?
I think so. I think what happens when we have these, you know, something that happens with nonprofits sometimes is that we are always putting out a fire, right? We're responding to a crisis. And in responding to those crises, sometimes we can lose a part of who we are, or staying kind of on message of what we're trying to accomplish or what our mission is. And so I think this is sort of like being, I think I use this on the panel today, it's like being a buoy in a storm, right? So that's my take.
Okay. Oh, so your panel's already done. You're relaxing now.
That's right.
All right, awesome. Congratulations.
Take it easy on us.
All right, congratulations. Yeah, this is fun. This is nonprofit radio. This is no gotchas here or anything. Okay, and I gather from the session description, Christina and Rhiannon, you've taken two different approaches in terms of politics. Christina, apolitical. Staying mostly apolitical. And Rhiannon, using the arts to be political, using theater to be political.
Yeah, and I think something about the public theater is we try and represent all sort of views. We are open to everyone, and we want to tell all stories. And especially in our branding, we did the same thing where we said very true to who we were as an organization and the urgency that people are feeling in the community and the power of storytelling to sort of tell people to share different perspectives and the power that storytelling really has to help people feel like they understand a different viewpoint than their own, whether that's depending on all sides of the political spectrum. I mean, the public theater being in New York City, we do tend to lean a certain way, but we try to be as open as all voices and all stories, and hopefully help other people understand, especially, as I said, we're divided right now. Helping understand other people and other perspectives helps sort of diffuse the tension and help people come at issues in a different way.
James, I think it's pretty well recognized that storytelling is critical. If we're not a theater group that has a stage, literally, how can we effectively, compellingly is better. Have the story told or tell it ourselves.
Yeah, no, that's a great question and
everybody's
a question
waiting.
That
everybody's
question
got fans. That came. You guys all have fans. Rhiannon, you didn't have a fan.
I have no fan.
Christina and James. No, you both wait. I thought you waited.
New Orleans is a small town. Everybody knows each other's people in New Orleans.
You're home.
You know?
Yes,
I'm waving now.
All right,
so there's your cousin.
To nobody.
My cousin.
Yeah, there's nobody
no,
coming
that's
by.
James' cousin.
Oh, that was legitimate? Okay, I thought you were just trying to make up for not having any fans.
So,
how do we do this compellingly?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. It's actually a question that came up in our panel conversation today from the audience, and Rhiannon answered it beautifully, and I'll try my best to kind of encapsulate her great response in that at the end of the day, yes, we might not be affiliated with an organization that is in the arts or in the theater or uses storytelling as the primary medium or platform, but the work that we're in the nonprofit world is all about human stories, right? It's all about change and transformation within humans and communities that they dwell in, that we serve. And so I think at the end of the day, you know, you might not have art as kind of the channel for telling these stories, but the better you can get at telling very human stories that connect to people at a very human and emotional level, I think that's where you get real power.
How do you drill down into that, getting that, making that connection with the reader or the viewer? You know, flesh that out a little more.
So I think one of the mistakes that a lot of organizations do is they get caught up in kind of explaining their model. Like, this is our theory of change, and here are all of our programs. Right, we invest in building community. We invest in entrepreneurs, whatever it is, we train leaders instead of thinking about why. Like, why do you exist? What is your purpose? What is your reason for being? Right? If you can start there, then you can begin to inspire people in a way that if you start talking about your products and programs, you might lose them. Right? So if you can start with why you exist, really drill down and get to your core purpose, I think anyone can really identify with that and begin to resonate with that message.
It's time for a break. Pursuant. The Roundup, the fundraising roundup. It's called the Pursuant Giving Outlook. They took all the latest fundraising reports, boiled it down to just what you need to know. Plus, they did a webinar on it, and you can watch the archive of that. It's an ensemble piece. The content paper and the webinar, both are on the listener landing page. That is at tony.ma/pursuant. Remember the capital P for please. Now, back to branding.
Okay, Christina, I see you doing a lot of nodding.
What's your experience? Yeah, I was going to say, you know, Brothers in Power to Teach, unlike the public theater, is only 4 years old, right? And so we're still kind of a startup. But when we first started, it was very much like, this is our model. We have these three steps. This is what we do. And people would be like, huh? And so when we started telling the story about why we do the work and why we think the way we do it matters, it was much easier for people to connect. And so I think that that's really, really important.
And you're trying to get black men to go into teaching, right?
Right.
Education,
that's
exactly
right.
Brothers, brothers empowered to teach?
Brothers empowered to teach. And sister bros empowered to teach, but yes.
Okay, okay. And now, you feel like you're creating a lot of buzz and a lot of conversation around your mission. How are you doing that? This is a way of rising above. You can get people talking about you. Right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I said today was that, like, show up, right? So we show up to lots of different things, and we show up in lots of different ways. So we participate in lots of activities going on around town related to the issues that we work on, but also on larger issues. Like, there's an initiative in New Orleans called Forward Together, and politicians, nonprofits, people who work in the private sector come together. So we go to those things. We're all constantly wearing a B, right? So that's one of the ways we show up.
Okay.
The other way is that,
it's on your shoulder,
it's
too.
On my shoulder,
okay.
Yeah.
Not only on your chest, but on your shoulder, too.
You know, we have young people who are very much engaged in the work that we do, and so they do a lot of videos for us. They do a lot of tweeting for us. We do a lot of social activities, so people see us collectively together, and they're like, what's that B mean? What hashtag Real Bros Teach, what does that mean? And so that's how we've really driven people to think about us.
Rhiannon, how about the public theater? How are you creating buzz, conversation about the pub?
I mean, the public theater is definitely a growing brand, especially in New York City. We had Hamilton, which was like a huge, huge public.
You had Hamilton before it was on Broadway?
Yeah, we created Hamilton. Excellent. We did the workshops and like sort of helped incubate that show. And then we did the first production. That was the production that moved to Broadway. So we had a lot of sort of like buzz from that show. And we're now in the place of like, okay, now that Hamilton's sort of moved on, continuing those conversations and keeping us as the forefront of people's mind as a theatrical institution, as well as a civic institution. We hold a lot of talks at that are hosted through our public forum team at our home in Astor Place. We also are doing them at the Delacorte. We hold other sort of initiatives. We did voter registration was a big thing. We had a table out in our lobby, and we sort of participated with other nonprofit theaters.
Okay, interesting. Voter registration.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something that intuitively I would link with a theater.
Yeah, it was an initiative that was started by, I believe it was Playwrights Horizons. They got theaters throughout the country to set up voter registration booths for when people came and saw shows. They could register for vote while they're like waiting in line or during intermission or after the show. And the idea is just to help people engage civically within their communities and in the country by voting. And we had a huge turnout. We also did some pushes on our social media and through emails, and we got a lot of people registered to vote. And it's our way of sort of helping people just be active within our community and engage socially, not just with the conversations that we're having with the work we're presenting, but just like in the real world outside of what's on our stages.
James, you're our resident consultant. How can we create conversation and buzz around our work?
I mean, I think
we just heard some great examples, but beyond those two.
Yeah, I think it does at the end of the day come back to having a clear sense of who you are, but also who your audience is. And we talked a lot today about authenticity, right?
Let's talk about that then.
Yeah,
let's do it here, too.
Yeah.
Don't hold out on nonprofit radio listeners.
And I think that the theme of authenticity is something that the three of us keep coming back to and is a common thread in all of our work. But, like Rhiannon said in the beginning, organizations that tend to shift their messaging or change who they are in response to what's happening in the world today without remaining true to kind of their core purpose or kind of their identity, I think there's a real danger there in kind of losing sight of what you're all about and why you exist. I think when you have a clear sense of who you are and, more importantly, how your audience connects with that, then that kind of authenticity shines through no matter what is happening around you. And I'm sure these two can say more about that.
Yeah, I think a lot of the questions we had today, no matter what the question was, are always kind of brought back to that authenticity and who you are and sticking true to who you are, whether it is like a post-election end-of-year campaign where there's a little different urgency within it, it's still about those fundamental things that make your organization what it is. People are going to see right through you if you're trying to like do something urgent that doesn't feel authentic or real, because they don't want to give money to an organization that's not going to do something with it that's what that is fundamental to who they are. Yeah. And so the public theater and like we have always stuck true to those values that we are a theater of, by, and for the people, and that culture belongs to everyone. And this is, we are a place of storytelling, and those are the things that are important to us. And just framing it in the way of the moment of it, whether it's urgency or what, no matter what it is, it's still those things. And every question we got today, we kept coming back to that authenticity and who you are.
Yeah, because Christina, you're not only alienating your mission, but you're also alienating your core supporters.
Right. I mean, you're also alienating the people who work for you. Right? Oh,
and your employees work, right. And your staff.
Right.
Yeah. They have certain expectations. And right. Now we're adjusting just because there's tumult in the political economy.
Right, exactly. I mean, we think of our brand as a person, right? So one of the activities we did when we did our brand refresh was like, okay, if Brothers Empowered to Teach was a person, who are they?
A user persona. Is this James's user persona? Or
I think that's part of it, certainly
yeah. Okay.
Part
yeah.
of it.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
And so, you know, we kept coming up with all the things that we already do that sort of reinforce who we are as a person. So we're a 20-something creative, collaborative, fresh and fashionable group, right?
What do we read? What do we listen to?
What do we read? Right? What do we listen right. to? Our podcast, you know, is all about those things. It connects our brand to people who want to hear about the work we're doing in more detail. And it translates into the photos we take and to our website. All of those things signify that.
Yeah, but I think, Tony, you just used an interesting word a minute ago, and that was expectation. And I think that's one thing that we actually didn't talk a lot about directly today, but certainly was a theme that I see woven in a lot of the work, especially the tactics that both of your organizations have used in the past year. And it can be something as small as the public theater in their year-end fundraising campaign last year. Instead of their typical, we're just going to send email after email appeal at the end of the year asking for our audience to give us money, they actually hand-wrote notes on postcards thanking people for their contributions, yeah. for their engagement. A very analog, old school approach in this very hyper, you know, social media digital world. And they saw a huge bump in terms of kind of, or are hoping to see a big bump in terms of renewals, but did see a big bump in terms of engagement just in response to that tactic. Which so that kind of analog, very old-fashioned, if you will,
yeah,
approach
was
really, really yeah. cut through the clutter when you're yeah. just getting bombarded on social media and email today. And similarly with Brothers Empowered to Teach, I think one of the things that was really interesting when they were going through their brand refresh, they had an exercise where they're, you know, looking at something as mundane as colors. What should our color palette be that represents our visual identity? That's a very standard part of any branding exercise, but the way that they thought about colors was really provocative for me, and I should probably just let Christina tell the story herself, but essentially, you know, what I heard was, and correct me if I'm wrong, that
Christina, tell the story.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
So our color palette is soft, so it's, and vibrant, so it's yellow, a teal, a lavender, and a cool gray, right? And the reason for those colors is because we did this today. We had all
teal, like your earrings.
Yes,
you got it down.
Like
you got it down to the earrings.
Essentially,
okay.
I had everybody close their eyes and say and think to themselves, not necessarily share. Like when you think of a young black man, what do you see, right? And so when they open their eyes, I said the reason these colors are the colors they are is because they signify liveliness and collaboration and nurturing. So a softening of the idea of who a young black man is, because we want people to see young men as nurturers, right? As having the potential to nurture. So that's why our color palette is the way it is.
We talked about this idea of, I used to come from the international development world, and this expression or phrase called poverty porn. I don't know if you've heard that, but it's kind of this, our imagery, we either use
negative
imagery that's very exploitive in an effort to raise money and awareness, right?
Yeah.
So malnourished kids in sub-Saharan Africa with flies on their faces, right?
Eyes, yeah.
That kind of creates this sympathy or pity. On the other hand, the pendulum has swung in the complete opposite direction in the last 5-10 years, where everyone uses just images filled with happiness and optimism and joy. And I feel like there needs to be a recalibration again, and something that's kind of in between that presents a more nuanced, complete, whole, and maybe complex picture of what the issues are that we're dealing with in the communities that we're serving. I think that there's a real danger in kind of dumbing down your message or your brand or simplifying it to say, this is who we are, this is what we're all about, and it's kind of playing into what people expect, right? Versus similar to what Brothers in Power to Teach did. And he said, how do we create an image that is more about fostering this nurturing environment? And then also in some of the photographs you see, it's like sometimes it's real struggle and adversity that you see, but sometimes it's real celebration and joy and just the complete humanity that's presented, kind of a whole human being. I think that's something that we don't see enough of today.
Christina, what's a home run for you? Is it when someone decides to embark on a career in education? Is that like they
majored
on that in college?
A grand slam home run out of Shea Stadium.
Yeah.
Mets fan.
okay.
Would be if a young man starts with us and doesn't want to teach, and by the time he leaves, he's like, you know what? I'm going to teach. So that's a grand slam.
Okay. Okay.
The basic home run is basically a young man who may want to teach but isn't really sure and decides to teach. But we've had a lot of success with guys who had no intention of teaching, because only 3% of all the teachers in the entire country are black men.
Black men.
They don't see themselves in teaching. So the idea that they now see themselves as a teacher or working in education, period, is like phenomenal, really.
Rhiannon, and you talked a bit about inclusiveness.
Mm-hmm.
Say more about that in terms of the public's brand. I mean, how do you feel being inclusive sets you aside from your competition in New York City?
The public theater, it's one of our fundamental sort of missions, is to provide theater to everyone, no matter what background you are. And I mean, we do Free Shakespeare in the Park, where we give 100,000 tickets to world-class Shakespeare every summer,
free, right.
All for free.
Right. Your heart is hell to get, too, a former New Yorker.
And we're making, I mean, that's the thing. They are hard to get. People have to wait in line for hours. So we are taking steps to make it easier to get tickets for everyone. So we do distributions in all 5 boroughs. Throughout the week, we'll be in Queens 1 week, we'll be in Brooklyn, we'll be in the Bronx, we'll be in Staten Island, distributing tickets there so that they don't have to come into the city, wait in line for hours, maybe or maybe not get a ticket, and then wait until the show in the evening. It's a more accessible moment for them to get tickets there. We also now have a digital online lottery, so people can do it from work or from wherever they are. We do a lottery downtown at our after place home, so again, you're not waiting in line. You can come, enter the lottery, get drawn, be quick. We are trying to offer more and more opportunities to help, expand who is seeing the theater versus the people who are able to wait in line. We also do the mobile unit, which takes Shakespeare to prisons, homeless shelters, and community centers throughout all 5 boroughs. And we do that twice a year. It used to be once a year. We've now expanded to twice a year. They do 20 stops each tour, and then they come downtown and do a three-week run at our theater at Astor Place, and all those tickets are also free.
Okay. Inclusion.
Yeah.
Anybody else want to talk about... No. That wraps it. Okay. Yeah, that's good for that. What else can we talk about? You had your workshop. We've got another 5 minutes or so together. What haven't we touched on? Anybody that we want to? Come on, you did 90 minutes.
Questions. I know. We're all talked up.
Questions? Maybe questions you got that we haven't talked about yet.
Well, one thing that didn't come up that some folks asked me after our panel was, you know, it's interesting because you have a very founder-led organization. You're a small organization. You're a young organization. On the contrary, Public Theater has been around for 65 years almost, and their founder is not, you know, directly involved anymore, but Oscar Eustace, who's been there for how long?
It was 10 years when I started, so 12, 13 years.
And
at this
he's
point.
Kind of an iconic institution in and of himself.
Yeah.
And so how do you think about brand in relation to a founder's personality? And if you work at an organization that doesn't have a strong founder with that really influences that culture, then what do you do? I don't know if you guys have thoughts on that. But
well, I've worked in, you know, prior to my previous career, I was a investment banker in community development. And one organization that I worked for went through a big brand refresh. The founder had long been gone. And what they did internally was sort of do what Public Theater does with the staff and sent out a survey, like, who are we? Who do we say we are? Who do you think we are? And who do you think we should be? And they did a whole entire brand refresh based on sort of who's in the building now, who works for the company now, why did they come to this place to work here. And I think they did a great job at rebranding themselves, Enterprise Community Partners. I haven't looked at their branding lately, but a few years ago they did that, and I thought that was a really great way to do it. When you don't have a strong founder culture anymore, the founder is, you know, your organization has evolved over the years. You've had another executive director, but you still want to stay kind of true to your original mission. I thought that that was a great way.
Essentially surveyed the staff. Why are you here?
Right.
And I guess, you know, another question taking that a step further is that I get all the time is, okay, we were sold, we should go through a branding exercise, a brand refresh, if you will, but how do we get the leaders of our organization on board? How do we get the entire staff on board to really buy into this so this doesn't just feel like a bunch of pretty words that we stick in a marketing drawer, but that has real impact on how we show up in every department throughout the organization every single day?
So how do we get that buy-in?
Yeah, that's my question. I don't know. I mean, you guys both live and breathe this every single day, and I'm happy to share my thoughts, but...
I mean, it's the public theater is such a deeply rooted mission, and Oscar, who is our artistic director, really lives and breathes the mission of the public, and truly the people who work there want to be there and want to be there for the mission of the public. It's, you know, it's nonprofit. You want to be there for that. You want to be there to help give thousands of people free tickets in the park and the work that goes behind it and to create good work. So we are kind of in a very lucky situation in that we are very, very rooted in our mission and our brand and who we are. And it stems from having a strong artistic director leader who any speech he gives, any from like a staff meet and greet to the Delacorte and opening night of Shakespeare in the Park, it is so rooted in who we are and so rooted in the deep belief of who we are. So it really helps everyone in the organization really get behind it, because you know that you're working towards something that for our leader believes in, and also that's something that we believe in as a group and as a theater.
Yeah.
So we're lucky in that it's so embedded in us as a public theater. I know a lot of theaters don't necessarily even have that. Theater is not something that people think of in these huge, huge, deeply founded missions and values and big. We have broad; they're broad and really lofty. Of culture belongs to everyone, and theater should be free for all, and all those things that. But there are things to aspire to, and there are things that we all are working towards as an organization.
James, if we don't enjoy that luxury that the public has, can you help us?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things that I try to teach my clients is that when they're going through a branding exercise, it's really critical to bring the entire organization on board throughout the process, right? There's nothing worse than going through a six-month rebranding and the leadership says, ta-da, we're done, look at our new brand. Everyone says, what? Like, how come I wasn't heard? How come I didn't get a chance to weigh in or at least share my opinions? And so I think that's a real, the fine line between, you know, a successful branding and a branding that ends up failing. I think it comes down to when you're developing a mission or a purpose statement, if you're developing core values for the organization, that you don't fall into the trap of just choosing empty words, right? We've all seen core values like empathy, innovation, honesty. Well, like who's not going to be honest? Like, who wants to be the opposite of that, right? So those kind of be empty, meaningless core values. How can you create a set of values that really change the way we show up to work every single day? And so one of the things that I do with my clients is after we have this branding, we bring everyone along throughout the process. They're entirely bought in. We say, okay, now we have this new set of values. Now we have this new purpose. Maybe we've written a manifesto. Really look at these words. Break up into your teams. So finance department, accounting department, marketing department, operations team. I want you each to go and meet and look at these words and really understand what they mean and have a conversation about what's going to change. What are you going to start doing more of today that you're not doing enough of? What are you going to stop doing as a result of the language on the words? At the end of the day, a lot of rebrandings come down to language and words, and the intention that you put into those really can go a long way.
Okay. We're going to leave it there.
Okay.
All right.
Right.
They are James Wu, independent brand consultant, Christina Jones, co-founder, COO of Brothers Empowered to Teach, and Rhiannon Tasker, donor communications project manager at the Public Theater. Thank you all. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
This interview is scheduled, sponsored by Network for Good.
easy-to-use donor management and fundraising software for nonprofits. Thank you so much for being with Nonprofit Radio coverage of 18NTC.
We need to take a break. Wegner CPAs, please talk to Yeet Uchtoom. You heard him on the 400th show. Plus, he's been a guest on the show a couple of times. Check out the firm, of course. Do your research. Then talk to Yeet. Tell him what you need. He'll tell you whether Wegner can help you with your accounting needs. No pressure. All professional. Got to do your due diligence. Get started at WegnerCPAs.com. Now, Tony's Take Two. I'm paying attention to baby boomers. Millennials get a lot of attention, of course, and that's deserved. They can be a very, very important part of your fundraising prospect pool, of course, depending on your mission. They'll be donors for 50 or 60 years. I'm not saying ignore millennials at all. We've covered it here on the show many times, lots of trends involving millennials, etc., and we'll continue to. But that I don't mean that as the universal negator. Along with that, my consulting, and hence my focus, is on baby boomers. They'll be around because I'm one, and I'll be around for a good 40 years. Actually, I'll be around for another 44 because I'm living to 100. So they'll be around. There's a lot of wealth in the baby boomer generation. They have proven to be generous with their wealth. Lots of reasons to pay attention to baby boomers and to promote and market the estate and retirement plan gifts to them, as well as paying attention to millennials. Again, this is not an either or. Depending on your mission and depending on the makeup of your constituents, they may both very well fit in. Okay? My video saying a little more on that is at TonyMartinetti.com. It's my pleasure to welcome Steve Rio to the show. He is founder and CEO of BrightWeb, a social impact consultancy delivering strategy, branding, and digital. He aims to build the world's most flexible, engaged, and efficient company. He's an expert in exponential organizations, remote and distributed teams, and workforce wellness and performance. He consults with impact leaders to reimagine their organizational strategies, systems, and company cultures. The company is at BrightWeb, BRITEWeb.com, and he's at Steve Rio. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi, how are you?
I'm very well. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good. Where are you calling in from?
So I'm calling from my home office on Bowen Island in British Columbia, Canada.
Wonderful. Bowen Island. How far offshore is Bowen Island?
So Bowen Island is the closest island to Vancouver. It's about a 20-minute ferry, but it's a small little community, about 3,500 people. So just a small island.
Okay. And you're a good, 6,000-7,000 miles from New York City?
That's about right. That's about right now, yeah.
Okay. Well, that's where I'm sitting. So, okay. It doesn't matter.
There you go.
2018. It hasn't mattered for a long time. Okay. You've been spending a lot of time learning about, researching the science of focus and attention. What brought you to this?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've been thinking about this. I guess as a leader of a company, about 5 years ago, we moved to more of a remote model where we're kind of embracing 21st century practices around, organizing people. So we started allowing people to work remotely and travel while working and doing things like that. And then a couple of years ago, we launched a distributed workforce of freelancers. And so we have freelancers in 25 cities around the world now. Over that time, what I've learned as for knowledge workers, there's an increasing onus on the individual to think about how they, manage their time, their work habits, how we organize our offices, whether those are virtual or physical spaces, and just really thinking about, the capacity and capabilities of our teams. And so I guess even for myself, thinking about how to maximize productivity and how to really achieve the most impact I can have in the work we do, it's become a key part of my thinking on how to really maximize our teams. So it's been a few years now where I'm focused pretty heavily on this subject.
Did you used to have a more traditional office where all or most people worked in one place?
Yeah. Uh, I guess that would have been about 4 years ago was when we started making that transition. We were working out of an office. So we have an office in Vancouver, but we serve clients mainly in the United States. So we have an office in New York as well. So as soon as we had two offices, that's when we started to think about how to have, you know, more of a distributed approach to work. And so about 4 years ago, we started making that transition.
Okay, I see what drove you to that. All right, so you could have come to the studio. You could have visited the New York office and come to our studio here.
That's right, but it happens to be summertime, and summertime on the island is pretty good, so...
I understand.
Yeah, I'm sorry I couldn't be with you in New York today.
That's okay. We tried to, but the schedules were just, you know, I'm not in New York all the time either. I spend a lot of time in North Carolina.
You do?
Where the beach, yes, I have a beach house there, and the beach is also very nice during the summer.
Excellent.
You might have heard rumors to that effect.
I have.
Ocean and beach life are very nice in the summer months.
Okay,
so you're interested not only in the, well, not only interested, but you've been spending time researching not only the conscious aspects of this, but unconscious.
Yeah, well, so to me, there's sort of a couple of key components. One thing is how we organize our time. You know, I think about this from, if we're thinking about the social sector, which is who our clients are and a lot of who I consult with and work with, I think about the capacity of our teams, because I think we have pretty severe limitations on budgets and on operational budgets specifically, and thinking about how to increase the capacity of our workforce. And I think one of the ways we can do that is by really looking at the way we structure our time and the way we, you know, what kind of habits we reinforce in the office place. And I think, first off, there's the component of just getting focused work done and thinking about distractions, thinking about how we're implementing technology and the sort of core components of that. But I think a second component is around creativity and around creating space and allowing people to actually have the time to think big and come up with creative solutions, which doesn't happen in a busy, distracted work environment. And when you're right in front of technology all the time, it kind of requires a level of space to be created for people.
And so let's get some ideas. How do you create that space?
So I think creating the space is it comes with, first off, an understanding of what it means. You know, what's interesting, like, you know, we're starting to work with universities in Canada as well as the U.S., and thinking about how we start to educate people from a younger age about what it means to be productive. I think we have, you know, as knowledge workers, most of us are knowledge workers in today's world, so we're working in front of a computer and we're creating documents or information products or things like that. We're a lot of communications. So oftentimes we feel like productivity is time spent in front of the computer or on our devices. And I think it's really important to realize that productivity and creativity comes also when you create space, when you go for a walk, when you take breaks, when you actually disengage from the, you know, actual document creation or the actual work you're doing and take time to process what's happened. So what's interesting is that we have a conscious mind and a subconscious mind. And for instance, when we learn new information, about 6% of that goes into our conscious mind, which is immediately available. And the other 94% goes in our subconscious mind, and that takes time to process, and that's where we kind of put things together and think, you know, that's where correlation happens, and that's where true creativity happens. And so, you know, I think most people would, you know, relate to the idea of the best ideas might come to them in the shower or when they're doing the dishes or when they're, you know, doing some task that requires very little cognitive effort, and that's when our creativity strikes. And so What I try and teach my team and what I talk to people about in our workshops and the work we're doing is about rethinking what productivity means and how creating space in your days and your weeks can actually be a very productive way to be a more creative contributor to your work.
This reminds me of the dark days when I practiced law, and in those days we didn't have, I didn't even have a computer at my desk. We were talking about 1992, and
right.
I'd have to stare at a blank ledger every day, and I knew I had to fill it up with at least 10 hours of billable activity, otherwise I'd be working that weekend to make up the difference. And there were all kinds of billing codes for producing tangible output, but there was never a code for thinking. I just spent time thinking about your case, thinking about what the best strategy would be, thinking about how to manage the relationship with this adversarial party. But I could never bill for thought.
That's right.
I had to build it into some document, some letter or memo to the file or to the client that I had written. This thinking time was never a billable activity. It wasn't a recognized thing that we should ask clients to pay for.
We see the exact same thing as a consultant. We're able to bill for designing a website or creating a strategic brief or leading a workshop, but a lot of that the thinking time is sort of out in space that we're not able to bill for, which creates an inverse relationship with the actual quality of the work that we're trying to deliver.
Yeah. All right, we just have a minute before a break. Tell me how you enforce this. How do you get people to create this white space in their work days?
Well, I think it's been very interesting trying to implement this with my own company over the last couple of years. And the hardest group to do this with is with young folks, with the millennials who have grown up as digital natives. And so it's kind of repeatedly letting them know that a big part of their job is delivering value, like deep, valuable thinking. And to do that, they need to create some separation from technology and from their devices, and they need to create space. And so really encouraging people to get up and walk around, to take, we take meditation moments through our days. We have these virtual meditations we do throughout the week that are just 3 to 5 minutes. Because I don't think it can be a short period of time or a longer period of time, longer the better, but even 2 to 3 minutes can make a big difference in your day, where you're actually fully disengaged and either in a short meditation or even just daydreaming and looking out the window.
Hold that thought. We got to take a break.
Yeah.
Telos. You've heard the Telosmonials from charities that referred companies for credit card processing. And of course, they're getting the revenue each month. And from companies who are using Telos for credit card processing. Can you use more revenue? Big question. Can you use more revenue? That long stream of passive revenue? I'll bet you could. Watch the video at tony.ma/TonyTelos. That's the way to get started. Now, back to Steve Rio. Steve, I'm guessing that a part of this is especially the millennials, who are the tougher nuts to crack, you said, they need to see you doing these things as well. Like, you're taking the virtual meditations with them, of course.
That's right. Yeah, so I think what's very key for organizations to realize is it has to start with leadership. And so I think in my case, I'm the CEO of my company. I'm the founder of my company. So I'm able to live these recommendations and these ideas, and to really create that opportunity for people to pick it up. Now, it's a serious behavior change for a lot of people who are very accustomed and perhaps addicted to their devices and to being engaged with technology and those kind of things. So really creating behavior change, which can take some time, but it does start with leadership. We also have to rethink the way we organize our offices and the way we organize our work days and start to create, periods of the day where people are allowed to work uninterrupted without the expectation that they're going to be responding to emails or taps on the shoulder or Slack messages that are coming in. I mean, the amount of distractions we're seeing in our workplace today is pretty insane, actually, when you think about how the brain works and what we actually need to do to be focused, creative, and productive.
So, again, maybe enforcement is not quite the right word, but encouragement. Sounds like you're stronger than just encouraging. Do you have these periods where people are, during which people are not expected to respond, and so that's their long-term, sort of thinking time and creative time?
Yeah, we do. We encourage people to use their calendars as a tool to block out time throughout their week, where it's very clear to everyone if they're looking at other, trying to find a time to book a meeting that we encourage 90-minute blocks of time, because that's really the amount of time that the brain can, we can focus on a hard cognitive task without needing a break. So these 90-minute blocks, we encourage those in the morning whenever possible, because that's really the most energy your brain is going to have for the day. And we also created some tools. So we use Slack like many companies. We use Slack for internal communications, kind of quick communications. But we've created a tool where people can basically turn on a snooze button for their Slack, which notifies others when they message them to say this person is in a focus, what we call a focus block, for X amount of minutes. And it indicates the amount of minutes before that person will be available again.
Okay.
So both some tools as well as practices. And then what we're looking at now is looking at sort of a shared timeline throughout the day that works, because we work on both primarily the West Coast and East Coast time zones of North America. But basically looking at a calendar format that works for both, where there's specific periods of the day where everyone is encouraged to focus in on their work, and other shorter periods of time where everyone is focused to then use those periods to collaborate, communicate, ask questions, and do all the regular sort of things that are necessary to move projects forward.
When you're interviewing people to work for you, do you bring up these topics and sort of assess their willingness?
We do. I don't really feel like it's a subject that is taught in universities or that many workplaces have ever really considered. So I don't necessarily expect people to come in with a knowledge of it.
Yeah.
But I do expect people to be open to it and willing to adopt it. And actually, as we've developed this content more and more, we've done two things. One is internally, we're starting to build a curriculum for this that will be basically required learning. It'll be part of our onboarding process that people will go through over the first month or two of being part of our company. Where they'll basically build these habits up, and these will be core expectations of our workforce. The second thing we're doing is we've created a new entity called Brightwell, and Brightwell's mandate is to help train and educate people through workshops. We're working, like I said, we're about to embark on a university tour to start teaching this as supplementary content to college students. So my goal would be that people start to recognize this as a core necessity for the workforce, not just being a subject matter expert in, say, fundraising or marketing or whatever your specific area is, but also your work habits. So really thinking about both as critical to success.
How often do you do the virtual meditations?
We have those happening every day of the week, and they're in a couple different times. And what they are is they're basically optional 5-minute meditations where people can jump on a video call, like on a video link. And we jump on the video, and we just start with everybody sharing a one-word kind of update on where they're at. So it could be stressed or excited or tired or just something to check in really quickly. And then we have a three to four minute guided meditation that we all listen to. And what's really interesting is that the actual act of taking those 3 to 4 minutes is really relaxing and rejuvenating, energetically. But it also brings people together in a very interesting way. We always end the calls with people with a big smile on their face and kind of connected in a way, even though we've been mostly silent together for those 3 to 4 minutes. So it's pretty neat.
How many of those do you participate in?
I try to do them at least 3 or 4 times a week. I participate in a lot of them. I don't lead them, but I try to participate in them a lot. I mean, I think, like I say, a lot of this is lead by example and show that even the busy CEO of the company can take that time. Creating that space is possible. It's a matter of sort of changing your mindset around how you structure your day.
We're gonna take another break, and when we come back, I wanna start talking about your encouragement for non-work hour mindfulness and attention.
Great.
Text to Give. You'll get more revenue because they make giving easy for your donors. This is our newest sponsor. Welcoming them again. If your donors can send a text, they can make a donation. How much simpler could it be? It's simple, affordable, it's secure. The CEO is Chad Boyd. You can talk to him. The way to get started is text NPR to 444-999 for info and to claim a special listener offer. We've got about 6 more minutes for focus and attention. And so, Steve Rio, let's make that shift. What's your encouragement for people outside the workday?
Yeah, this to me is such a critical area, and it's very interesting to try and impact people's personal behaviors, right? And
yeah.
But I think it's a critical component of our success at work is our success out of work. And I think, to me, they're all combined these days. So there's a few things we really focus in on. One is people's morning habits. So how do they start their day, particularly the first 30 minutes of their day? So really encouraging people to wake up without technology, so to stay off of the internet and off social media and off their email and things like that for the first 30 minutes of the day. It's proven it's a very critical time where we're shifting mind states from a sleep to a conscious state, and it's a key time to sort of tell the brain what type of day am I going to have? Is it going to be a fragmented, distracted day where there's all sorts of news and emails and alerts coming in, or is it going to be a day where I'm focused on my priorities? So the morning routine we talk a lot about. There's other aspects of that too where we just think about, can you get some physical time in, or some like even if it's just yoga or a walk or something like that. But how do you think about your mornings? And then similarly,
before you move on, I want to focus on the morning. All right, so you're recommending. All right, so okay, so it's fine to wake up with your phone. Okay, your phone is your alarm. Okay, you silence that. Sounds like don't put it on snooze. Take an extra 10 or 15 minutes. Right, that's bad probably. okay, and now set it aside. Don't check email. Don't look at the latest alerts. What do you want me to do right after I hit that silence button on the alarm?
Yeah, so I think probably the healthiest thing you could do for your day is to wake up, to spend the first few minutes of your day perhaps thinking about your top, maybe what you want to achieve that day. Maybe thinking about what you're grateful for, like, taking a few minutes to have a bit of a gratitude practice. So a simple way to think about that is just every morning, think about three things that you're grateful for. And those could be, somebody important in your life, some project you're working on, the sun is out. It could be very simple things, but taking a few moments to be grateful and to feel good and excited about your day. And then I think also spending that first few minutes doing something physical if possible. If you can get up and the first thing you do is get outside and breathe fresh air and go for a walk, that's a very healthy way to start your day and to warm up your body and your mind.
I can stop in the bathroom first, right, on my way to the walk?
Absolutely.
Okay, but don't eat anything. Okay, right, because otherwise I'll have bladder pain. It would be a terrible walk. So
you could wake up and make your coffee or make your tea, or like, I think just having basically a morning routine that is calm and present, where you're spending time in the present moment, whether it's like a lot of people, for them, it's the ritual of making a great coffee and thinking about their day and looking out the window and just, taking a few moments to be very present at the beginning of your day is a great way to ground your energy and be more resilient when you do start, get into your work environment and you start getting emails thrown at you and all sorts of information. You have a lot more resilience and ability to be, present and capable of handling whatever's thrown at you.
Now, this sounds good intuitively. Is there research that bears this out? This effect throughout the day that you're describing?
There is research around the way that you start your day. So when people start their day with technology, whether it's work related, so say emails or other kind of alerts, first off, any type of work emails or things like that can immediately trigger an anxiety response. Even if it's not necessarily a negative thing, it could just mean, oh, there's an urgent thing or something pops up. And so when you start your day with that way, you basically have a heightened dose of what's called cortisol in the body. And this is
when you're stressed.
This is one of the reaction to stress.
Stress so hormones.
Stress levels basically spike right out of the gate without having a warm up to the day.
Mm.
And then there's also research that shows when you start your day with technology, your brain is basically triggered into a highly reactive state, which means that you're more likely to be distracted and less able to stay on task through the morning. Or through the day, I mean. So So you're more likely, you're basically telling your brain, if you think about our brain in a more, you know, primitive sense, if you wake up and you're immediately alerted to 30 different things, you're basically telling your brain, today is a day where I just need to be aware of anything that moves around me, which is not necessarily the state you want to be in when you want to get some focused work done.
Okay. So the research bears it out. All right. All right.
That's right.
Anything else? We have just about 2 minutes or so left. Anything else for outside the work hours that you recommend?
Yeah, I would say the absolute most important thing people should be thinking about outside of their work is their sleep. And in North America, we have a serious issue. 1 in 2 adults are sleep deprived. You know, 1 in 3 adults in North America are surviving on less than 6 or less hours of sleep. And this is having a massive effect on not only our cognitive ability, but our health and well-being and our mood and our mindset. And so I think it's one of the most undervalued, most important things we should be thinking about is getting a necessary amount of sleep. There's just an incredible amount of research not only showing the health issues that are related to a lack of sleep, and by a lack of sleep I really mean 6 hours or less or anything in that area, which a lot of people consider to be a fairly normal amount of sleep, but also the amount of cognitive decline that you experience. So I think a lot of times we have this relationship with time where we think, well, there's not enough time to sleep. There's so much I got to get done. But then when we don't sleep, our productivity and our capacity and our ability to process is so low that we're actually kind of creating a negative feedback loop.
All right.
And we're getting less done with our time. I think sleep is the other area that I think people should be really focused in on.
And for optimal sleep, you want a dark and quiet space. I've done the little 100%. Research. We got to leave it there, though, Steve. But thank you for saying 100%. Steve Rio, you want to learn more from him? Find him at brite.web.com and tweet him directly at Steve Rio. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you. And a good night, too. Next week, Amy Sample Ward returns with Overmarketing. If you missed any part of today's show, I beseech you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled. Tony.ma/Pursuant. Capital P. Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers. WegnerCPAs.com. By Telos Credit Card and Payment Processing, your passive revenue stream, tony.ma/TonyTelos. And by Text to Give, mobile donations made easy. Text NPR to 444-999. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Liebowitz is the line producer. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy. And this music is by Scott Stein. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network. Are you stuck in a rut? Negative thoughts, feelings, and conversations got you down? Hi, I'm Noreen Sumter, the Potentiator. Tune in every Tuesday at 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time and listen for new ideas on my show, Beyond Potential, Live Life Your Way, on talkradio.nyc.
Hey, all you crazy listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talking Alternative with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply email at info@talkingalternative.com.
Are you into comics, movies, and pop culture at large? What about music and TV? Then you're in for a treat. This is Michael Dolce, your host on TalkingAlternative.com. I've been professionally writing comic books, screenplays, and music articles for almost 15 years. Catch my show, Secrets of the Sire, at its new primetime slot, Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and get the inside scoop on the pop culture universe you love to talk about. For more info, go to secretsofthesire.com.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network at www.talkingalternative.com. Now, broadcasting 24 hours a day. Talking Alternative.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to the Talking Alternative Network.